This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the first week of January, and this week an American airstrike in Iraq killed top Iranian official Qasem Soleimani. We also killed several leaders of Iranian-backed militias inside Iraq. This is a remarkable escalation, and yet it's also a continuation of four decades of fighting between the United States, the Islamic Republic of Iran, and our various proxies. Soleimani was arguably the second most powerful man in Iran. He led the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, and he was the architect of Iran's various military interventions in the Middle East, supporting Bashar al-Assad in Syria, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and perhaps most relevant for the U.S., supporting militant attacks inside Iraq that killed hundreds of American soldiers. On Friday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the attack on Soleimani was based on intelligence that he was imminently going to undertake an attack of his own that could have killed Americans. The big question, of course, is what Iran will do now that we have killed him. President Trump has repeatedly expressed a desire to avoid war with Iran, and at times he's acted out that desire through restraint, as when he called off a counterstrike in response to Iranian attacks on Saudi oil facilities. But Iran can be expected to respond to this attack, and the attack could also damage our partnership with the Iraqi government. The Iraqis were already sore over our military actions inside their country, and Iraqi forces had stood by and allowed the Iranian-backed militias to ransack the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad earlier this week. An enraged Iran and a damaged relationship with Iraq could mean a lot more instability in an already unstable region. And future attacks on American interests could lead President Trump to further escalate our military conflict with Iran, whether or not he thought he had intended to do that. Now let's bring in our left, right, and center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left, Elizabeth Brunig of the New York Times. Hello.
Hi, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
So in today's show, we'll look at developments in the 2020 primary campaign, including impressive fundraising totals from a number of candidates. And later on, law and economics professor Natasha Sarin will join us to talk about Pacific Gas and Electric, the troubled California utility whose aging power lines have sparked wildfires, required widespread blackouts, and driven the company into bankruptcy for the second time in two decades. We're going to use PG&E as a case study to look at how the United States succeeds or fails at holding companies accountable. But first, Michael Singh joins us to talk about that airstrike that is rocking the Middle East. Mike is managing director and senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and former senior director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council during the George W. Bush administration. Hello, Mike.
Hey, Josh.
So, Mike, Soleimani was a big deal, but I don't think he was exactly a household name in the United States before this airstrike. Can you give us a sense of what his importance was?
Absolutely. He was a very significant figure in Iran, especially for its sort of most odious policies from the United States point of view. He was Iran's sort of military and terrorist mastermind, operating as kind of the point of contact for the likes of Hamas, Hezbollah, Shia militants in Iraq, the Houthi rebels in Yemen, as well as overseeing the sort of Iranian regime's crackdown on domestic protests and things like that. He had amassed a tremendous network of proxies in the Middle East, tremendous influence inside Iran, and was probably Iran's most powerful military commander, as well as you said, Josh, it's probably second most powerful figure, period, after the supreme leader of Iran.
So, Rich, I hear a lot of people basically laying out that list of, you know, that resume, we could call it, for Soleimani, saying, you know, he was a bad man who did terrible things. We should be glad that he's dead. I'm not sure that addresses the most relevant question here. I mean, Kim Jong-un is a bad man who killed lots of people who I think you could make a strong argument morally deserves to die. That doesn't mean a decapitation strike to take him out would be a good idea. What is the argument that this was a good idea, that this serves U.S. interests, that we will benefit from having taken Soleimani out?
Yeah, so it's definitely everyone should welcome him being dead. It makes the world a better place. But the question is, what strategic effect does it have? And it's just too soon to say. I think this could have been a brilliant move, could have been a foolhardy move. And what happened next will determine how we ultimately view it. Certainly, it's a tactical victory. He, as some people have said, was really the indispensable man. He was uniquely skilled at what he did, a cunning, ruthless guy, and a cold-blooded killer of hundreds of Americans. So we'll see. This is Trump. He took a massive step up the escalatory ladder, kind of leapfrogged the Iranians, who are the ones that were steadily creeping up the ladder, with Trump really not doing anything in response. And the best case is that this does create a deterrent around harming Americans, which if the Iranians take that to heart, it will limit their retaliatory responses. But maybe that's not the lesson the Iranians take, and this is going to spiral to someplace very ugly. I don't think anyone can say with certainty.
Yeah, Liz, I think that's the thing that a lot of people are afraid of. I mean, Rich laid out what I think is supposed to try to be the limiting principle here, which is to say that the president is reacting to things that Iran has done to American interests, to American personnel, basically trying to lay out a line that, you know, they're not to attack our forces, they're not to cause problems specifically for us in the region. The question is, can you really have, you know, can you deter Iran in that way, in a way that is credible, without setting off an escalating set of retaliations that leads us into a wider war?
Right. I mean, that's the really disturbing possibility. I think Rich is right in that I don't know that anybody knows where to rate the likelihood of that at this point. It's very early in the process. But I think that what concerns a lot of people, especially people on the left, is it's not the case that Iran just aggressed the United States willy-nilly in the region. As a matter of fact, we had an agreement set up with Iran, which was meant to handle all of these tensions. It was a major diplomatic breakthrough, and Trump pulled out of it. Trump pulled out of it because it was a big part of Obama's legacy, and he wanted to destroy Obama's legacy. So in a sense, Trump actually is a provocateur in this case, and he was willing to try to provoke further conflict, it seems. And so it's important. Possible for me to say that Trump will do the wise thing here, much less the right thing, based on the fact that his motives with Iran appear to be really, really deeply messed up.
Mike, what do you make of that? I mean, the Iran nuclear deal, I think I would dispute Liz's characterization that it was supposed to address all of these issues. I think that it was meant to hive off the nuclear issues from some of these others. Iran was still causing a lot of various other problems related to our interests in the region. But I think Liz is right to say that that seemed like an unnecessary provocation on the president's part that led to increased hostility in general, and may have, you know, made it created a more acute situation where he felt compelled to do this.
Well, I think in a sense both are true, Josh, because number one, I think we can say that despite the nuclear deal, Iran showed very few signs of relenting or backing down from its very destabilizing policies in the Middle East. But certainly in the nearer term, over the last, say, 6 to 9 months, Iran was engaged in a campaign of regional and nuclear escalation. And don't forget, they're supposed to make a nuclear announcement next week. Designed to deter the United States and get us to back off of our maximum pressure policy. You have to take into account both of those things. You know, Iran wasn't doing anything new when it was trying to dominate Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. That's been their MO for the past 40-plus years. But there also was this kind of more specific recent context in which you have to see these actions now.
So what should we be concerned about what might happen next? Because I think as we're trying to figure out, you know, what are the effects of this going to be, there's this basic idea, right, that, you know, Iran will feel compelled to retaliate. I guess the question is, you know, we already had extensive tensions with Iran. Are there things that they had not been doing that they are now going to do? What form would that take? What sort of attacks should we be concerned about? And what could the knock-on effects of that be, Mike?
Well, we are certainly in uncharted territory, Josh, and therefore it's hard to know exactly what's going to happen next. We have, in a sense, opened up a new category of conflict. You know, oftentimes policymaking happens in categories. You know, we decided, for example, finally to sanction Iran's oil, and then we sort of sanctioned everything related to Iran's oil. And so one question now is, does this open up this category of sort of targeting senior leadership in a way that will become routinized? We don't know. I think, though, we have to look at a few things. Number one, it's not just a question of Iran's response. Iran, I think, will have a response. It will look to retaliate, and probably in a very painful and significant way because of Soleimani's significance. But there's also the question of Iran's proxies in the region. They have perhaps their own agendas, for example, getting the United States out of Iraq. And of course, their leaders were hit as well, and their agenda may not align perfectly with Iran's. And then third, you have to look at the organizational dynamics. Soleimani was a key decision maker in the Iranian system, a key kind of node in their whole apparatus. And now that he's been removed, we should expect to see jockeying by individuals, by organizations for influence and power within the system. And there could be external kind of manifestations of that which are bad for us. And so I would expect a pretty rocky road ahead, frankly. Now, you can balance that, Josh, against the idea that whatever Iran does, it now has to assume that the United States is willing to push back. And that may be the sort of silver lining in this, that President Trump, whether you agree or disagree with his Iran policy, has certainly dispelled the notion that he's a sanctions-only guy, that he's not willing to sort of tangle on the ground with the likes of the Iranians should they test him.
Well, so, Rich, I guess then that raises the question of what the administration's objective is here, because John Bolton, the former national security advisor, was saying on Friday morning that, you know, that he welcomed this and that he hoped that this was a step toward eventual regime change in Iran. Now, I look at that, and I am skeptical that this would push in that direction. In fact, the indications I've seen are that Soleimani was very popular within Iran. This could be a uniting event for Iran internally. So I guess is the objective here simply to contain Iran, to basically say, don't screw with us? Or is the objective something larger, that, you know, the regime change that certain figures in the Republican Party, like Lindsey Graham, have talked about for a long time?
I'm not sure I know the answer to that. And I'm not sure you put Donald Trump under truth serum whether he quite knows the answer to that either. I've long thought that the ultimate goal here was negotiations. But this may take us on a different path. And yes, it might unite aspects of Iranian public opinion, but this is also a really shocking blow to the Iranian regime. Have this key figure wiped out like this, and sort of just a stunning. We've talked about Iran, you know, for years now, and it didn't even occur to me that this would be a measure that the United States government would take, and Trump did it. And now, in terms of what Iran can do, it has a lot of options running the gamut from, you know, hitting Saudi Arabia again, which it's done before without eliciting much of a reaction. So that would be on the more cautious side, all the way to, you know, activating the global terror network it has, including in the West and even in this country, which would be going way up and taking an enormous risk. But it seems to me like the locals would probably be in Iraq, where they do have the political and military means to force a disorderly U.S. retreat from Iraq. But that might require killing Americans. And do they really want to take that risk? At the very least, I think you'll see you're likely to see some mobilization of crowds, you know, around the funerals for Soleimani. There'll be one in Iraq as well as Iran, and you know, put us in an awkward position. Our forces in an awkward position confronting notionally peaceful demonstrators, you know, maybe surrounding the embassy and staying there for weeks or for the long term. But again, this is all just speculation and guesses. Donald Trump is opened a door, and we don't know what's in the next room.
Liz, do you have a theory of what the president thinks he's up to here? I mean, I think the sum total of his record on Iran is a little bit odd, in that, you know, he pulled out of the deal. I think you identify correctly that it's, you know, he doesn't like things that are part of Obama's legacy. He thought it seemed weak. But then he, up until this point, has mostly been interested in acting through economic sanctions, has flinched from previous possible military interventions, maybe is aiming at this sort of thing that sets, you know, specific delineations about what Iran can and can't do. But it's not clear to me that the president has really thought through any of this and is prepared for the eventualities that might arise out of this action.
No, I think Trump is at heart someone who is opposed to, you know, military interventions. I think he wants to be a sanctions-only guy, and not for any moral reason, but because he finds these overseas entanglements to be tedious and difficult, and he notes that people don't tend to like them, that the American people are sort of exhausted by Iraq and Afghanistan. And so I think that is his total reason for being a sanctions-only kind of guy. But I think that his lack of principle enables the people around him to manipulate him into making moves that he has no sense of the gravity of. And so he's in a position of great control, but he's also someone who seems to be very capricious. And so I'm sure that Trump doesn't have a sense of what comes next. I am almost certain that he doesn't realize what he's done. He probably thought that it was a show of strength or a show of toughness, and that it could protect Americans. He likely has in his head Benghazi, with the attack on the embassy. We know that he endlessly compares himself to Hillary Clinton. So, you know, it seems to me possible that he intended to make a pretty strong showing to indicate that he wasn't going to have a Clinton-like failure a la Benghazi. But nonetheless, he has gotten himself into something that seems a lot bigger than he was prepared for.
Do you have any sense, Mike, of what the discussions might have been inside the White House that led to this? I mean, I imagine that the president can't wake up in the morning and say, you know, kill Soleimani, and then the military can just do that at a press of a button, right? Did we need support from Iraqi intelligence, for example, to figure out where to conduct this strike? Is this something that would have had to have been a long time in the planning? And how deeply thought through would these strategic questions have to have been before this happened?
Well, look, I imagine as Iran was ramping up its regional aggression and as we saw what Iran was doing, say, in the Gulf and in Iraq, various options for responding, including sort of contingency options, were debated. And you know, it may be that a decision was taken a while ago that should the opportunity present itself and should Iran attack us, that this is the sort of thing that we would do. And I think it's informed in part by a couple of decades of relative American restraint in dealing with the Iranians in places like Iraq and Syria, and the fact that that restraint has not really gotten us the sort of lack of escalation that we've looked for. That said, I think on the previous question, Josh, I do have the sense that the Trump administration really does still seek a negotiated deal with the Iranians. But I think that now is the time where we're going to need to offer clarity to partners around the world as to where is this leading? You know, is this a change in policy? So part of the sort of, you know, after action checklist here for the administration has to be to go and reassure allies as to what is this path that we're on? Because a lot of them will be very uneasy, including in the region.
Do they have the capacity to do that with the staffing that they have?
I think the staffing is not the question in a sense. They do have, you know, plenty of people who can go out and do this and deal with allies from sort of the secretary level on down. I think the problem is the inconsistency of our messaging, because President Trump obviously has his megaphone, and that often is disconnected from messaging efforts throughout the administration. So it may require more discipline than we've seen so far and more clarity than we've seen so far from the administration.
Well, we will certainly be following this as it develops. We're going to leave that there. Mike Singh of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Josh.
Let's take a break. I'll be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Elizabeth Brunig of the New York Times to talk about the 2020 campaign. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switch to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at the New York Times. Democratic presidential candidates have been strongly critical of the president's choice to undertake this attack that killed General Soleimani, fearful of the escalation and blowback that it could lead to in the Mideast. Republicans seem eager to have that argument, saying essentially that Democrats are against killing a terrorist. Liz, I want to ask first about the differences among the responses from the Democratic candidates here. Are there important differences? I mean, I guess the main difference with the way Bernie Sanders has addressed this is sort of not starting with the throat clearing that you hear from a lot of Democrats about, you know, Soleimani was a bad guy who did bad things and we're glad that he is dead. I guess, is that an important distinction in the foreign policy in terms of how you approach this? Or is it basically similar to saying that, you know, we think that he was a bad guy who was against U.S. interests, but we're very concerned about the knock-on effects from killing him?
I think that the absence of the throat clearing does matter. I think it signals that there isn't a door here in Sanders' foreign policy vision that leads to a wider, more retaliatory stance. Another thing that Sanders did that others haven't done is he called the killing an assassination. And he was incensed in his statement that wasn't run by Congress, that it was sort of a unilateral thing that Trump decided to do. On the other hand, I think that pretty much all candidates have been emphatic, I would say, that this can't lead to another Iraq-like endless conflict. So that was something that we saw in Pete Buttigieg's statement. He said he had serious questions about whether Trump was ready to deal with this situation. Elizabeth Warren likewise said that she was not confident that Trump could handle this situation. And so I think that they're basically on the same page, with Sanders being a bit more in the camp of this is an assassination. It's possibly illegal, that it wasn't run by Congress, and it's a bad idea.
Yeah, so, Rich, Republicans seem, to some extent at least, eager for the politics of this. Now, obviously, I think the politics of it are going to depend tremendously on right. what happens next. Mm-hmm. So that makes me wonder, the president sort of, the president didn't make a televised address to the nation about this. He finally made some tweets about it on Friday morning. I guess as we're taping the show, we're expecting him to have a media availability at some point in the afternoon. But it's been strange to me, the president's lack of eagerness to get out in front of this story. And it makes me wonder whether, you know, he wonders about what this thing he's done is even going to do, and whether it's something he's going to want ownership of in a few days or a few weeks or not.
It's certainly an oddly restrained reaction from the president so far. Now, that may change very soon. But I think the throat clearing, as you put it, is appropriate for the Democrats. I mean, I think it's just natural to feel glad that this guy is gone, you know. And as people pointed out, if you see an Iraq vet walking around with prosthetic limbs, there's a good chance that that grievous wounding goes back to this guy. So I think that has to be acknowledged. And I also just think substantively, it's not the case that this is was an assassination. Our presence in Iraq has been authorized by Congress. He was a combatant, Soleimani, who, if you take the Pentagon's statement sincerely, the night of the operation was planning attacks on U.S. Personnel, which isn't hard to believe because that was his job. So this was not illegal. It was not an assassination under the laws of war. But I think just in sheer political terms, it makes sense for, I'm sure he's sincere, but for Bernie to differentiate himself in this way, and tonally and a little bit substantively, to be in a different place than the rest of the field.
Liz, on the assassination matter, I mean, I've seen people making the argument Rich made there. David French has been writing this, saying essentially, you know, that because this attack wasn't in Iran, it was in Iraq, it was on a military commander who was, you know, who was acting as a combatant, that this was not an assassination, at least in the legal sense. I guess what is your argument that it is illegal? But then I guess the separate question is, you know, there's obviously an important diplomatic and strategic difference between killing a figure like this, who is of such political importance in Iran, that regardless of whatever the legal framework is, I think people are right to worry about the response that it's going to draw, that it's different from just, you know, an ordinary, you know, a death of an Iranian in military action.
I think the argument for it having been an assassination is that, you know, he wasn't essentially functioning as a combatant. I think that Bernie Sanders in particular feels like this is part of a sort of ongoing narrative, not even about the Trump administration, but just about American foreign policy in general, where, you know, greater and greater escalation takes place in the Middle East without any involvement from Congress, which represents the interests of the American people. So it's a step that is going to, it seems like, enormously change the landscape in the Middle East in terms of American involvement. And I think Sanders would have liked to have seen Congress involved in that decision, since it appears, at least at this point, that it could involve the United States in a pretty dramatic way. And I think that's a fair concern. I haven't seen extended arguments about the legality of it. I'm sympathetic, however, to the idea that even if it were technically legal per the Pentagon in their release, it is nonetheless a situation where Congress should have a role in any kind of action that's going to implicate the United States in a pretty dramatic way.
Rich, isn't the way that we opened this conversation basically not knowing what the consequences of this are going to be and not having a lot of confidence that people in the government really know what the consequences of this are going to be. Isn't that just a reason that there should have been some congressional deliberation in this, that, you know, if we're going to basically take a shot in the dark and have no idea whether this is going to lead to a wider war or not, that feels like something we should have all talked about.
Yeah, I think it's obviously tricky in a specific operation like this. How do you can't really have a congressional debate over whether to carry out a secret operation to kill an enemy commander. Now, if we're going to declare war on Iran, you know, obviously that would require congressional action. But we have the authorizations in the war on terror and the Iraq war. They are really long in the tooth. In general, presidents of both parties have kind of run free of congressional guidance and deliberation when it comes to carrying out combat operations. So I take that general point. I just don't think you could have seriously had a congressional debate about doing this.
Of course, this is just one of several issues that are going to be key as Democrats head toward the Iowa caucus about a month from now. We just got fundraising totals in that race that come out at the end of every quarter. Bernie Sanders raised over $30 million in the fourth quarter. Joe Biden, Pete Buttigieg, and Elizabeth Warren all raised more than $20 million, $16 million for Andrew Yang. Liz, this is a very big total for Bernie. And I also think, and maybe she did a good job of expectations management, even though Elizabeth Warren came in fourth, I think her number cracking over 20 million was a little bit stronger than people had expected it would be.
Yeah, I think that her number being very close to Biden's in particular, Joe Biden, 22 million or just over that. I mean, I think that's pretty impressive. And I think that it's a different story than the one you're hearing in the media, which is about how Elizabeth Warren has taken this precipitous dip in the polls. You look at the polling averages, she has come down quite a bit from her peak, and it happened pretty quickly. But the fundraising suggests she does have sustained and durable support.
And Rich, in the aggregate, the Democrats way outraised the Trump campaign. So I think, you know, a better measure of enthusiasm on the Democratic side than we've seen in some of the prior quarters.
Yeah. So, I mean, those are all pretty good numbers for all the top four contenders, and a great number also for, you know, a fringe cause candidate in Andrew Yang. But just the Bernie number is off the charts. You know, it's eye-popping and just goes to how he's genuinely twice now created a massive grassroots movement behind his candidacy. And he started now taking shots at Joe Biden. Buttigieg has as well, which is appropriate given his persistent presence at the top of the polls. And Bernie is making an argument that I think if in the abstract, that if you subtract for Biden and Bernie's like politics and who they are in their records and whether they're socialists or not, is a pretty persuasive one. It's, you know, we need someone who's going to generate enthusiasm to beat Donald Trump, and these fundraising numbers are a sign of a fervent support for Bernie Sanders in terms of winning the nomination. It's a question of how much he can grow, obviously, over and above that base. But that base itself is really impressive.
Yeah, Liz, what do you make of Bernie really increasingly taking it to Joe Biden? Because one of the narratives about this campaign has been that, you know, people don't want to take Biden on directly. Hurt Kamala Harris. It hurt Julian Castro, who has dropped out of the race this week. But Bernie seems to me like the one who's getting the cleanest shots on him. And in an environment where there's been so little public polling over the last few weeks in early primary states, you know, the freshest polls from a few weeks ago had Pete Buttigieg in the lead in Iowa. But I think what some people are reading between the lines, but the way that Bernie is engaging with Biden, is that maybe the numbers have shifted there, and that's, you know, Iowa is now a fight between Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, I'll be very curious to see those updated numbers when they come out. I think everyone's watching Iowa kind of with bated breath, especially because of that interesting Buttigieg jump, which I have to credit Rich for predicting a while ago.
Every couple of years, a prediction of mine proves out.
I think that Bernie is doing a smart thing by taking on Biden, and I think he's doing something that's important for him to do, which is to distinguish himself not as a protest candidate or something along those lines, or a candidate who was simply an alternative to a Hillary Clinton candidacy, but a candidate who's a legitimate front runner, someone who has a big base. I think he has, if I'm correct, and nothing has changed, the largest number of contributors to his campaign. And he also has thousands of people knocking on doors and working a grassroots canvassing effort. And a lot of those are very young people, people who typically aren't interested in electoral politics, especially primaries. So he's captured a piece of the Democratic base that's important to capture that Obama captured. And so I think he's doing the right thing here and setting himself up as someone who is a legitimate front runner, can take the nomination, and should be taken seriously as an alternative to Biden, even by people who don't identify necessarily with the radical side of Bernie Sanders.
I've been talking with Liz Brunig of the New York Times and Rich Lowry of National Review. We will be back with Natasha Saron from the University of Pennsylvania to talk about Pacific Gas and Electric. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at the New York Times. Now it's time to talk about power. Electric power. If you weren't reading the Wall Street Journal over the holidays, I really recommend picking up a feature story they ran on December 28 called Wired to Fail. It's a history of Pacific Gas and Electric, the California utility that's bankrupt now for the second time this millennium. Lately, PG&E is most famous for wildfires that have been sparked by its malfunctioning equipment, including the Camp Fire north of Sacramento that destroyed almost 19,000 structures and killed 85 people in 2018. The California Public Utilities Commission found that PG&E broke 12 safety rules in the events that led up to the Camp Fire, and that its lapses were, quote, indicative of an overall pattern of inadequate inspection and maintenance of transmission facilities, unquote. PG&E was supposed to have reformed after previous failures. Back in 2010, a PG&E gas main in San Bruno, south of San Francisco, suffered a massive explosion in which 8 people died and several dozen homes were destroyed. The National Transportation Safety Board investigated and found the main had been improperly installed in the 1950s and that PG&E had failed for decades to inspect it properly. So the company was criminally tried and convicted for its failures in the San Bruno case. It paid over $1 billion in penalties. It greatly ramped up its spending on gas line maintenance. But as the Wall Street Journal describes, the company declined to ask itself whether it was paying the attention it needed to its electrical lines. That led to disastrous consequences. Now the company is bankrupt due to all the liability it bears from all the damage its fires have caused. And since the company's ability to pay is limited, much of the cost of that damage is going to fall on others, on taxpayers, on ratepayers, on insurers. So whose fault is all of this? And if criminal charges after the San Bruno explosion didn't get PG&E into line, what can we do to stop companies like PG&E from making mistakes that cost other people's lives and money? Natasha Saron joins us now to discuss that. Natasha is an assistant professor of law and finance at the University of Pennsylvania, and one of the topics she researches is corporate accountability. Hi, Natasha. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Josh. Thanks for having me.
So obviously, it's not just PG&E. This is related to themes that we discussed after the financial crisis. Isn't there something that we should be doing, perhaps with the criminal justice system, to hold corporate actors accountable? Are we doing enough on that front in the United States?
So your parallel to the financial crisis is actually a very good one and at the heart of some work I'm doing right now with Dorothy Shapiro Lund, who's a professor of law at the University of Southern California. And what is really quite striking is that in the aftermath of the savings and loans crisis in the United States, 1,100 people were jailed for malfeasance committed that led to that crisis. In the aftermath of the financial crisis in the United States, one mid-level executive was jailed. And it's our view, and it's, you know, we're talking about different kinds of industries, we're talking about utilities, we're talking about heavily regulated banks, but I actually think it is a sort of theme that applies throughout, that when you don't have a way to hold individuals accountable for malfeasance that occurs by corporations who are run by individuals who commit these bad acts that can be negligent, that can be criminal, with consequences of loss of lives, of loss of livelihoods, you don't really have a way to punish as aggressively as we need to be able to do. And so what we are trying to sort of encourage is real thought on what it means to hold corporations accountable. And for us, we think that that means holding individuals accountable, and particularly holding corporate executives accountable who create cultures that allow for these sorts of disasters to occur.
Rich, isn't this something that capitalists should be especially eager for? I mean, the purpose of limitation of liability for corporations is to encourage the taking of useful risks. We want people to start companies that may involve, you know, risks of capital so that there are innovative ideas and useful things in society. It's not supposed to be cover for criminal acts or for things that end up, you know, doing untold damage to people who never invested in the company, were never exposed to be exposed to risks from the companies. I mean, hasn't, you know, there been a lot of damage to the reputation of capitalism from the decisions that were made, for example, in the banking sector leading up to the 2008 crisis? And if you want to defend capitalism, shouldn't you want more accountability there?
Yeah, I think the financial crisis, we've talked about this before. In my view, what really created the crisis is a bunch of people were sincerely wrong in thinking that housing prices would always inexorably go upwards. And that was really the key driver rather than malfeasance or fraud. And when it comes to PG&E, I mean, the company has been held accountable, but there are just limits to what you can do to make a company efficient and well-run, and especially when there aren't real market pressures, which there aren't in this highly regulated space. The governor, Gavin Newsom, has said PG&E is an indicator of the downside of dog-eat-dog capitalism, but this has to be one of the most regulated companies in the country, and at least part, not all, but part of its difficulties are a result of regulation, which in my view was totally focused on the wrong thing, which was the state was overwhelmingly concerned with pushing PG&E into more renewable energy sources, which drove up rates and created less appetite for the expenditures that would have been involved in updating its infrastructure and avoiding to the extent possible power lines causing these horrific fires.
So, Natasha, what do you say to that? Because this is an argument I hear a lot in response to the idea that we need more criminal accountability, either for individuals or for corporations, is that basically a lot of the things that people would like to criminalize are not really crimes. They are honest mistakes, and that the criminal justice is basically the wrong tool for some of these. I mean, is there a way to measure, you know, when you say that there were so few prosecutions in the wake of the financial crisis, are there specific crimes that you can point to that were not prosecuted? Or was it, as Rich describes, you know, honest mistakes that people made that weren't criminal acts?
So I'm going to make Rich's point for him, and then I'm going to refute it. So to Rich's point, there is great empirical work that suggests that exactly these banking executives who I'm talking about during the financial crisis were themselves invested and heavily exposed to subprime mortgages and the housing bubble in a way that suggests that they just, you know, this was a risk that the world just missed. And so is stupidity really a crime? That is what you heard from Tim Geithner in the aftermath of the crisis, as well as others. And really, who are you going to be holding accountable and for precisely what? And so I take that point. My response to it is that the word fraud appears in the Financial Crisis Inquiry Report almost 1,000 times. And so, you know, in the lead up to the financial crisis, there were, in fact, fraudulently originated mortgages. We all know this. The question is, can you tie sort of bank executives to crimes that are committed by people that are much lower than them on the totem pole? And this is where I think we need, and that's kind of what Dorothy and I are thinking about, a different way to think about criminal liability in this context. And so a good example from the aftermath of the crisis, also in the financial industry, is around Wells Fargo and fake accounts. And so there, I think we can all kind of agree, egregious bad behavior committed by a number of bankers in order to try and meet targets, unrealistic targets that were set for them by executives who may not themselves have known what their sort of targets were leading to, but certainly created a culture that encouraged criminal behavior that harmed real people. And so what we think is really quite important is to find a way to punish individuals and individuals who hold a lot of power in these organizations for those sorts of corporate cultures. And we just don't think, and you know, I talk a lot about criminal accountability and we should send more people to jail. And the reason I think that quite strongly is because we just don't have the capacity to fine these incredibly large, incredibly profitable organizations to the extent that we would want. Instead, what these fines amount to is like a parking ticket for bad behavior, which doesn't deter much of anything. But if we're not going to go all the way there because of some worry that, you know, are you really going to throw people into jail for being sort of negligent or being asleep on the job, I think we should think about doing that. But certainly much more aggressive public shaming than we do of these executives today. When the CFPB reached an agreement, and the Fed reached an agreement with Wells Fargo, deciding that four of their directors would have to leave the board, they said that they weren't going to publicize the names of these individuals because it was sort of, they had decided to be anonymous and it wasn't fair to the corporation or to its directors. I think that's kind of very misplaced focus on preserving anonymity of institutions when in reality we need aggressive public accountability for these individuals. But another point that Rich made, by the way, which I have a lot of sympathy for, is we need to be careful when we think about words like capitalism or regulation as regulation always being sort of a good and capitalism always being sort of a good or always being a bad, depending on which side of the aisle you're on. I think that sort of PG&E is in fact a good example of a corporate crisis that is created by an industry where there is excessive regulation and there is also an inability for the market to function the way it should in order to create a culture that will be able to be successful in this utility space. I actually think those are slightly different kinds of problems than exist in banking, which is also a very heavily regulated industry, but one where we should pay a lot more attention to the kind of culture that is being created.
Liz, as you listen to that and sort of Natasha describing how you might fine-tune the incentives around corporations and corporate executives, I wonder if that sounds satisfactory to you, sounds like something that can work. Because, I mean, obviously, you know, the corporate form and the limitation of liability in the corporate form is sort of a big, powerful thing that is given to corporations and their owners and their executives. And there are, you know, aspects of the way our criminal justice system works where things have to be proved to a high degree of certainty that have allowed corporate executives to hide behind exactly the sort of ambiguity that Natasha describes there. You know, well, we instituted this policy and maybe we should have known that because of the rules that we imposed, branch managers were going to end up doing certain things that defrauded customers, but you can't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that we knew that. It makes me wonder what you would think about the prospect of using the criminal justice system basically to fix the ability to abuse the corporate form.
I mean, I think there's a role for the criminal justice system. I do think that it is difficult because, you know, precisely because of the problems with the corporate system. And I also think it's difficult because the criminal justice system just seems ill-suited in a lot of cases to handle these types of crimes. I think we saw that after the financial crisis. I think that the people who are being or would be indicted here because of their, you know, enormous wealth have a huge capacity to grapple with the criminal justice system in the way that your average person who winds up involved in the criminal justice system just can't. And so I think that, you know, sort of greater regulations, greater incentives, you know, it's all worth a shot. I don't think any of those things are bad things. But I would put something else on the table aside from, you know, just criminal justice responses or greater regulations and incentives. I would punitively nationalize corporations that end up causing deaths and huge environmental disasters like this one. And why don't we take a shot at running a utilities company? A lot of countries do that very successfully. I think that one of the issues with trying to get corporate executives to run corporations in the way they should is that you rely on things that hurt other people to hurt them. So you trigger their self-interest in some way, or their self-interest begins to abut these concerns about being indicted, which they're not really, or fined, which they're not really. So you can try to fix that incentive structure, or you can hit them where you really know they're going to get upset, which is you're no longer a corporate executive. This is now a public utilities company.
Well, so I wonder about that, actually. I mean, Liz, let's talk about the PG&E example there and utility ownership, because it seems to me that the equity owners of PG&E have already faced the consequence that they would face with nationalization, which is to say the company's bankrupt. The value of their equity has gone to zero. So they, you know, the stockholders have already been punished in that way. And I wonder whether that would fix the specific problem here, which is to say, you know, you had this long period over which PG&E, as a heavily regulated company, both faced significant pressure to hold down the rates that they were charging to ratepayers. And they also faced significant pressure and legal requirements from the state of California to increase the renewable share of production, which ended up increasing their costs. And so the corners that they cut in terms of maintenance were aimed at squaring that circle. It seems to me that you could still have exactly that same problem under public ownership, that the pressure to keep rates down would remain, the pressure to make certain changes in the business, maybe for good reasons, to shift toward renewable energy would remain. And so, you know, you could have the same this specific same kind of failure from a public entity as from a private entity. So, I mean, do you think nationalization would lead to better maintenance decisions by utilities necessarily?
I think a couple of things. I think that in the event, again, we don't know exactly what would happen, that a nationalized, you know, or public utilities entity was making the exact same mistakes with the same reasons that PG&E has, I think that at least there would be some public accountability and we wouldn't be sort of scratching our heads as to what to do, because the public accountability in this case was the criminal charges and that didn't seem to do anything. And then on the other hand, I think that these kinds of takeovers of companies that have proven their malfeasance again and again would create a climate that would deter other corporations from cutting similar corners. So I think that it would be an example that might have a positive and beneficiary chilling effect on corporate culture writ large, in that once this becomes a penalty that is enacted, does happen, has happened, corporate executives who are sort of reckless in their dealings would have a very serious deterrent.
Rich, what do you make of that? I mean, as you've noted, this is a heavily regulated industry already. And to a significant extent, utilities act as arms of the government, and they have monopolies over certain services, which are the cause that the government has to regulate them so heavily. When you have them be privatized, don't you have the risk of exactly what we've seen with PG&E, whereas when things go well, then the profits accrue to private shareholders, and when things go badly, you end up with costs that are so high that taxpayers end up bearing them? Would it be more efficient to have the government basically admit that this is a matter of public ownership and have them run it directly?
No, I think it, as a general matter, that private shareholder-owned utilities are more efficient than municipal utilities. And ideally, you'd want a competitive market in retail power sales. But I just don't nationalizing the economy is not good for consumers. It's not good for accountability. Our experience in the 70s in the West, when we had many more nationalized industries, was not a happy one. And then if I could circle back to Natasha's point, I think public shaming, given the circumstances, I'd be fully on board of that. I just think it's a key principle in Anglo-American history that violations of the law have to involve real bright lines that are clearly understandable to everyone beforehand. Otherwise, you create an intolerable situation that is really detrimental to individual liberty, where you have an executive at a company that might be giving people marginal loans that, you know, in 2000 would work out fine for everyone, but in 2007, when the system was about to tip over, would be a debacle, including to the person who got the mortgage, and you might be thrown in jail for it. So your criminal liability would just depend on these broad market forces, and that's just not the way the criminal law should work.
Natasha, what do you say to that?
So I kind of want to go back to Liz's point about how, you know, why she doesn't think that criminal liability is necessarily the answer. And one of the things she said was that these people, these corporate executives, just have at their disposal sort of infinite resources to fight the criminal justice system in a way that regular people don't. And for that reason, we should think about nationalization. I think for that reason, we should think about whether our criminal justice system is working the way that it should. I think that to the extent that what we see, and Jesse Eisinger has documented this in a great book called The Chicken Shit Club, and Judge Rakoff has talked about it extensively as well, there is a reluctance by sort of enforcement agencies to pursue individual level criminal liability in many of these cases because of a concern that they will lose. And a concern that they will lose precisely because individuals who are very wealthy and very powerful have tremendous resources behind them. And I think that that creates a two-tiered criminal justice system, or a one sort of scale for rich people who have at their disposal a lot of resources and commit white-collar crimes, and another scale for people who are poor and commit not white-collar crimes. And I think it creates an unfortunate reality, which is we get ourselves to thinking that we need very sort of radical, we need to think about nationalizing industries, and that's the way forward to make sure corporate accountability exists. I think we're kind of giving up a little bit early in that you're right, that we don't want a system in which if I'm a corporate executive who oversees a bunch of loans being originated and I can't anticipate where the bubble is going to come, and a bubble comes and people lose their homes, people go to jail. I understand that we don't want that world to exist. But if a world exists where there is fraud being committed by your employees because you create a system where it is untenable for them to meet goals that you have set for them by doing anything other than committing fraud, and then the only thing that happens until sort of John Stumpf is drawn before Congress and doesn't do a good job testifying is that 5,000 regular people lose their jobs, that seems to be a system that is set up to disadvantage regular people and at the expense of promoting corporate executives and sort of rich shareholders of those companies. And so that gets us to a situation where we think we need extreme solutions. I think we need to think about seriously whether we are doing enough to enforce the rules that are already on the books and whether we need a kind of new theory about corporate accountability rather than the one that we seem attached to presently.
Natasha, while we have you here, and we're going to do this as an extra for the podcast, I want to ask you a little bit about the wealth tax proposals that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have put forward, because you've been a part of this public debate. We had Gabriel Zucman on the show a few weeks ago. He's one of the architects of Warren's wealth tax plan. You've been writing with Larry Summers, saying that he and his collaborators who worked together putting together the plan, that they're too optimistic about how much revenue a wealth tax would raise. What are they getting wrong in your view?
So let's talk about why we think the Size and Zucman estimates are wrong and why we think it matters, which are two sort of separate points. The first point about why we think the revenue estimation is overly optimistic has several different components. So one component that tends to get obscured in the debate among academics, but is actually very critically important, is that we actually do not know how much wealth the very top of the wealth distribution has. And, you know, Gabriel and Emmanuel rely on a set of estimates that suggest that the wealth tax base is at the very top is sufficient to create a wealth tax that will generate around $3.75 trillion once you include their sort of 6% billionaire surcharge in a decade. What is really interesting is there is new empirical paper by Eric Zwick, Owen Zadar, and Matt Smith, who's at Treasury, where they make the point that if you adjust for the fact that really rich people and regular people are simply invested in different kinds of assets. So we think about a fixed asset class. Regular people, fixed assets is like bank accounts. Really rich people, fixed assets is like high yield. And you make that adjustment, the wealth tax base shrinks by half. So nothing else about sort of how difficult, how administratively cumbersome, anything else just adjusting for the fact that rich people and regular people are invested in different kinds of asset classes that have different returns changes how much revenue you think a wealth tax can generate and changes it by half. And on top of that, there are a variety. The exercise that Larry and I do is we take the experience of the estate tax, which is the closest thing that we have in the U.S. to wealth tax, and we say, how much does the estate tax generate based on the fact that we can kind of think of it as a wealth tax on the group of people who pass away every year, and say, what does that say about what a 2% wealth tax will generate? And what we find is that that very simple exercise, adjusting for the fact that when you die, you can leave your estate to your spouse, adjusting for the charitable contributions, suggests that the wealth tax is going to generate like 40% of the Gabriel and Emmanuel estimates. And so all that is to say that we both don't know presently and in this estimation how much money exists at the top for us to attempt to tax with the wealth tax. And we also don't know how administratively cumbersome and how loophole-ridden whatever wealth tax that is actually implemented in practice will be. And I think it's really quite important for us to think about both of these questions in the context of this debate, because once you have revenue estimates that have been put forth by sort of very serious academics like Gabriel and Emmanuel on wealth taxation, it suggests that this one approach is going to be able to pay for meet both the growing revenue needs of the government presently that come from the fact that, you know, the population is aging, inequality is rising, all of this, and also we're going to do a whole bunch more sort of progressive proposals around free college, around Medicare for all, and we're going to fund it all through this sort of silver bullet of a wealth tax. And our sort of guess is that when revenue estimation and sort of scorekeepers get around to scoring the wealth tax, which, by the way, the Penn Wharton folks have done very recently, the estimates are going to be much less optimistic than what Gabriel and Emmanuel have offered, and suggest that you are going to need to look at other kinds of really progressive tax proposals that we think are exciting and very important. Things like investing much more in compliance, things like getting rid of debt-to-income basis, things like a lot of loophole closures and corporate tax reform.
Liz, I wonder how important you think this is. And what I would relate that to is the different ways that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren talk about the wealth tax. If the purpose of the wealth tax is basically to reduce the wealth of billionaires, then obviously the compliance stuff is still important, because if they are evading the tax, then you're not succeeding as much as you thought at reducing their wealth. But if the purpose of the tax is basically, you know, for the restructuring of wealth in society, then you may not be as concerned about missing the revenue estimates as if the wealth tax is really a key fiscal plank in your effort to pay for certain government programs. And it feels to me like Elizabeth Warren talks about it much more as a key fiscal plank, talking about here's the money I'm going to raise from this, and here's the things I'm going to spend it on. Sanders seems to me to talk about it more as an effort to reshape society that maybe makes it less of a concern how the scoring works out.
Right. I think Sanders has wisely taken the emphasis off of pay-fors in laying out his wealth tax proposal. Elizabeth Warren, understandably, because she's running a little bit closer to the center of Sanders, you know, for a variety of reasons. There are a lot of reasons she might be doing that. But I think that one thing she wants to avoid is coming off as, you know, quite as ideological, quite as radical. She wants to appeal to a part of the base that wants to see that more wonkish sort of centrism on display. And so I think she feels obligated to provide, you know, very detailed plans. That's sort of become her central thing in her campaign. You know, she's got a plan for that. So I feel like she's under immense pressure, and a lot of it of her own creation, to provide these detailed stories about how she's going to pay for things. And then you meet the other pressure on the opposite side of that, which is that people don't like to hear about a lot of new taxes. So I think those kind of opposing pressures have put her in a position of making the wealth tax a far more central plank than it ought to be, perhaps, of her campaign. And then, have Sanders on the other hand, who's open to other things, pretty much says that there will be other taxes, more focus on compliance, et cetera, in order to pay for the programs he has proposed. So I think he might have gotten the better of this one. But then again, his campaign doesn't operate under the same pressures that Elizabeth Warren's does.
Rich, Natasha listed some alternative ways that you can seek to tax the wealth of rich people other than a direct wealth tax. And I'm wondering if you think that the wealth tax debate, even though I assume you think it is unlikely to lead to the actual imposition of a wealth tax in the United States, whether it's shifted the conversation on that at all and whether you think that's been in a good way or a bad way. I mean, for example, the step up in basis, which Natasha mentioned, this is a tax benefit where if you own an asset, a piece of real estate, stocks, whatever, and they have appreciated when you died, you get to leave them to your heirs and no capital gains tax is ever collected on that. It's a big loophole in taxes on capital income that mostly benefits people with very high incomes. There's a bipartisan proposal right now from Mitt Romney and Michael Bennett in the United States Senate that significantly curtails that tax benefit. They would redirect it toward expanding the child tax credit. So it seems to me that that's an example of a conversation that is, you know, a lot more administratively feasible than a wealth tax, a lot more politically palatable, but that would move the U.S. tax system in a direction that is more progressive and that is aimed more squarely at trying to prevent people with lots of wealth from avoiding ever paying tax on the income that's related to that wealth.
Yeah, it moves the needle a tick in that direction as opposed to the lurch that would be represented by the wealth tax. I do think, you know, the populist strain on the right now, it's curious about more spending and kind of inclined to more regulation in certain respects with big tech, where I think ultimately it's going to go logically is towards favoring more taxes on the wealthy to pay for all this, to pay for any new spending initiatives, and as a product of just the inexorable drift that if you think our society is unequal and unfair, you know, the way the Bernie and Elizabeth Warren and the left does in certain respects, you're going to end up in some of the same places in terms of a solution. Just Liz's points, I think, are very shrewd and help me kind of understand the difference between Bernie and Elizabeth Warren on the specifics. But it's just been really notable to me how Bernie is radical and vague and Warren is radical and relatively detailed. And the trajectory of the debate and the race over the last 6 weeks or so suggests that radical and vague is better than relatively detailed.
I think we can leave that there. We're out of time. Natasha Saran, Assistant Professor of Law and Finance at UPenn, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, guys. I had a great time.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Liz Brunig, what's your rant?
So, warning, this contains Star Wars spoilers, but only in the vaguest sense. I'm a Star Wars fan. I was excited to see it at the end of the year, and I did. And the only thing I would ask, if they're going to make any more movies, and now that Disney has a hold of it, I suspect they will, is can we get a new story? This essentially rehearsed the exact same story that we saw in the prequels. The fall of a formerly good Jedi into a Sith who becomes evil and then becomes good again. We've seen it all before. It's very boring at this point. Give me something new.
Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
Anyone with a passing familiarity with the historical record knew that the New York Times 1619 project on slavery in the United States was tendentious and dishonest in important respects. Now, a handful of eminent historians have written the Times to ask for a correction of key mistakes. The Times, of course, has declined, but hopefully the historians speaking out will give educational systems around the country pause when they consider adopting the 1619 project as part of their curricula.
For my rant, Oslo, Norway has a population of nearly 700,000, and in 2019, the city had just a single traffic fatality, a driver who died in a single car accident. That means no pedestrians, no cyclists, and no passengers died in Oslo traffic last year. And that's an improvement from decades ago when the city used to suffer a few dozen traffic deaths annually. Many American cities have put increased policy focus on preventing traffic deaths. They use this buzzword, Vision Zero. The vision is to get to zero traffic deaths. Now, of course, there's always resistance to the changes toward these ends because safer traffic tends to mean slower traffic. But Oslo shows us this doesn't have to just be an airy, aspirational idea. With the right policy choices, you really can reduce urban traffic deaths to almost nothing. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Liz Brunig, Mike Singh, and Natasha Saran. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.